All right, now remember that last time we were talking about one of Mendel's experiments, specifically the one in which the characteristic that was being tracked was flower color. And in slide 5, we can see a partial explanation of the results based on how chromosomes work. Of course, Mendel had no idea, even until he died, what a chromosome is. But we can understand it from the viewpoint of a chromosome. Now, we see two chromosomes here, but that's not to say that pea plants have two chromosomes. They have, I don't actually know the number for pea plants, but it's much more than one type. Both of these chromosomes are of the same type. Right? There's two chromosomes, but there's only one type of chromosome shown here. And all of the other chromosomes are totally being ignored, because all we're paying attention to in this experiment is one characteristic that is governed by or controlled by one gene. Any given gene, of course, is on one particular chromosome or another, right? What is a gene? Not a sequence of amino acids. A sequence of what? Nucleotides. In other words, any given gene is simply some subset of the tremendously long sequence of nucleotides that the chromosome is. And any given gene, therefore, belongs to or resides on one particular chromosome. In pea plants, there is the so-called flower color gene, and it happens to be on this chromosome. That's why we're ignoring all the other chromosomes. But why are there two shown here? Two chromosomes? Yeah, what is the homologous, the fact that these are homologous, what does that tell you? Not copies, because they're not the same sequences. But there's two chromosomes, but they're of the same type, right? These are the same chromosome types because each of these two chromosomes carries the flower color gene. Why are there two, though? Two chromosomes. In this individual. This is not necessarily. What does it mean for this individual to have two chromosomes that carry the flower color gene? Yeah. No. Well, I mean, fertilization created this individual. So yes, you can say that. But that doesn't get to the answer. What does having two chromosomes of the same type indicate to you? Diploid, right. This is a diploid individual, just like we are diploid individuals, right? Our cells are diploid. The cells of this flower's body are diploid cells. So this is part, remember, plants have an alternation of generations, but we're talking about the pea plants that we look at and see are the diploid versions. Okay? So why is it diploid? Which is another way of asking, why are there two? Right. There's two because there are two parents for a sexually reproducing species, not just one parent. So it got one of these chromosomes from one parent and one from the other parent. But now it's its own individual. It has diploid cells, and therefore two of this same type of chromosome, the only type that we're interested in because it's the only chromosome that carries the flower color gene. All right. Now, in a previous lecture, I told you that any given kind of gene is called that particular kind of gene because it governs a specific characteristic. But I said that there can be different versions of the same gene. And that was a little vague at the time, but now we can look more specifically at that. If there are different versions of the same gene, then those different versions are called alleles. In this case, there are different versions of the single gene that we call the flower color gene. One version results in purpleness in the flowers. One results in whiteness. So there is a purple allele for the flower color gene. There's a white allele for that same gene. With those definitions in mind, we can say something important about correspondence. A gene corresponds to a characteristic, whereas an allele corresponds to a trait of that characteristic. So understanding that statement I just made requires you remembering the difference between a characteristic and a trait. Do you remember what I said the difference is? We use the words interchangeably in everyday life, but not in genetics. That's right. And so make sense of it in your mind that a gene corresponds to a trait. This is the flower color gene because it determines flower color, whatever the flower color ends up being. But each different version of that same gene, each allele, corresponds to a trait, a specific value of the color. There's a purple allele and there's a white allele. Those are the two traits of the same one characteristic, flower color. Does that help now to think of it that way? Or does it? Is that clear? I guess I should say. All right. Well, any given gene is somewhere in the genome. The genome is the entire collection of DNA for an individual. Any given gene is DNA, so it has to be some specific place. First of all, it's on one chromosome and not the others, which is why we're paying attention to only this type of chromosome. But also, whatever chromosome a gene is part of, it's located, that subsequence that the gene is located at a specific position on the chromosome. The chromosome is one enormously long sequence, the gene is a subsequence somewhere in there. And that specific position for a given gene is called its locus, which is really just another name for location. Okay, so a locus is not a physical structure. It's simply the position on the chromosome where that particular gene is found. And what's occupied by the locus is an allele. Some allele for that gene. Now, if you're talking about a diploid individual, which we are here, then there are really three possibilities, only one of which is shown here. One possibility that's not shown is that both of the alleles that the diploid individual has, right, there's two alleles, right, because you have two chromosomes of the same type, so there's two alleles. One possibility is that those two alleles are the same version, two of the same allele, in other words. That's not what's shown here, but that's a possibility that you can hopefully easily picture. But notice that there's two ways that can happen. If it is the case, though, that both of your chromosomes, or an individual's chromosomes, have the same allele, two of the same allele, in other words, then that individual is called homozygous. Homo meaning same. But that word does not fully describe the individual, because there's two ways that can happen. Right? One way, in this particular example, would be for an individual to have two purple alleles. But that would be homozygous. But you could also have two white alleles and be homozygous. So homozygous by itself is not enough to fully describe an individual. We don't use that word by itself. Remember that we talked about dominance and recessivity. One allele is dominant over the other. One trait is dominant over the other. In this case, purple is dominant over white. So in the specific case of having two purple versions, we would call that individual homozygous dominant, not just homozygous. But you could have two white alleles, and that would be homozygous recessive. Well, the only other possibility is the one that's shown in this slide, namely having one of each, a purple and a white. So when that's the case, it's not homozygous, because they're not the same as each other. Instead, it's heterozygous, hetero meaning different. Well, unlike homozygous, the word heterozygous stands alone, because that's enough to fully describe the individual. Keeping in mind, of course, that all we care about is flower color at the moment, just one characteristic at a time. Heterozygous is enough as a word, because there's only one way for that to happen. You have to have one dominant and one recessive allele to be heterozygous. Now, you might think that there's two possible ways, because you could have purple from the father, white from the mother, or purple from the mother, white from the father. That's true, but they are really the same case. It's still the case that you have one purple and one white, and so it's heterozygous. In other words, don't use the phrase heterozygous dominant. Just use heterozygous. Okay, now, with those definitions in mind, let's go on to slide 6 and revisit this same experiment. What kind of cross is it? Not the cross. What kind of cross is taking place here? Or is being conducted? Color is not a cross type. Color, specifically flower color, I assume you mean, is what? Is an example of what? What is flower color here? The characteristic. The only one characteristic that we're paying attention to. All the other characteristics we ignore, like how long the stems are or anything like that. Flower color is the one characteristic. So, that should be a hint as to what kind of cross it is.
Monohybrid.
It's a monohybrid cross. The mono meaning that we are caring about only one characteristic, flower color. What is the hybrid part of the word refer to?
Well,
there isn't really a mixing. What's happening is in a monohybrid cross is that the parents making up the P generation, the parents being crossed, differ in their trait for the characteristic that's being tracked. So flower color is the one characteristic, that's the mono part. Hybrid refers to the fact that one parent has one trait of flower color, the other parent has another trait. One's purple, one's white. Okay, now this brings up two more definitions.
The first of these is phenotype.
And phenotype really is just another word for trait when you get down to it. Phenotype is what you actually observe. And observe does not necessarily mean see visually. It is in this case. You can look at a plant and see that it's purple flowered, for instance, or white flowered. But it doesn't have to be a visible observation. It could be how much substrate gets converted into product in a given amount of time. You know, anything that's observable is that particular individual's phenotype or trait. So phenotypes we use phrases to indicate, like purple flowered, that's a phenotype. White flowered is a phenotype. Those are phenotypes of the same characteristic, right? So phenotype and trait, more or less the same thing. A similar sounding word that's different, though, is genotype. The genotype of an organism is a symbolic representation of that individual's specific allele or alleles. So we don't use phrases, in other words, for genotypes. We use a string of symbols. And the symbols themselves represent actual alleles that that individual, or that a cell of that individual has. And we see both on slide 6. Next to appearance are phenotypes. Purple flowers, white flowers, those are phenotypes. Phrases that actually describe the specific traits. Genetic makeup is genotype. And notice that these use strings of P's, the letter P, not the fruit that we're looking at in pea plants. Notice, though, that each parent has a genotype consisting of two letter P's. Why two? Why two P's in each genotype? Yes. In other words, each of these parents is diploid. A diploid genotype is going to have a string of two symbols. A haploid genotype would have only one letter P in it, because there would be only one chromosome carrying the gene in question, or the gene under study, if it's a haploid. Well, this is a diploid. These are diploid parents. Now, notice that only P's are used for both purple and white. P is chosen here because purple, that starts with a P, is dominant over white. So that will always remind you of what the dominant allele is, regardless of which allele you're actually looking at. But to distinguish dominant from recessive, an uppercase version is used to indicate the dominant allele. So uppercase P means a purple allele. And a lowercase version of that same letter, P, is used to designate the white allele, the recessive allele. All right? Well, these are not only both diploid genotypes, one for each parent, but what other word would you describe them? What use to describe them? What kind of genotypes are each of these? Or is each?
Homozygous.
Which corresponds to a phrase we used earlier, true breeding. A homozygous individual is a true breeding individual because by being homozygous, it has only one type of allele to pass on to a prospective offspring. This one is homozygous dominant, upper P. This one's homozygous recessive, lower P.
So is purple always dominant, or is it case by case?
It's case by case. It's always dominant for flower color in pea plants. But it depends on the species, it depends on the characteristic. All right. Now, if this cross is actually going to go through, meaning if these parents actually do produce offspring, as a preparation for that to happen, each parent individually first has to make gametes. And what process produces that from a diploid? If the parent is diploid, what process produces gametes? Meiosis, exactly. Because to prepare for fertilization, which is going to double the ploidy, you need to cut the ploidy down to haploid so that the zygotes that are produced are only going to be diploid again instead of tetraploid. And that is done randomly, meaning one of these two alleles that's in the diploid parent is going to be selected randomly for each gamete cell that's produced. Well, in a homozygous parent, it doesn't matter which one is chosen. You're going to choose an uppercase P, meaning that when all you care about is this one characteristic and you ignore everything else, despite the fact that there are almost infinite number of gametes that could be produced by this parent when you consider everything, with respect to just flower color, there's really only one kind of gamete each parent can produce. This one can produce only a purple allele containing gamete, because it doesn't matter which uppercase P you choose. And this one can produce only a white allele containing gamete. Is that all clear? And notice that the gametes are haploid and therefore have haploid genotypes, just one P each. That has to be done before there's any possibility of fertilization. You have to have gametes produced. Then you have to get them together. That's what Mendel did artificially. But since each of these two parents, being true breeding, can make only one kind of gamete with respect to flower color, then when you get the gametes from each of these two parents together, there's only one possibility with respect to flower color. Every one of the F1 offspring, however many are made, there could be thousands that are produced, every one of them is going to have the same genotype, because every one of them is going to get an upper P allele from one parent and a lower case P from the other parent. Every genotype, in other words, of the F1 is going to be upper P, lower P. What word do you describe for that genotype? What word do you use to describe that genotype?
Heterozygous.
In other words, in a monohybrid cross with true breeding parents, every one of the F1s is going to be heterozygous. Well, this explains Mendel's observations. Remember that in the F1, he saw zero white-flowered individuals. Every one of them was not only purple, but fully purple, just as purple as the purple-flowered parent. This happens because of dominance, and specifically because of complete dominance. Purple is dominant over white, but more specifically, it is completely dominant over white. What complete dominance means is that it requires only one or more, but at least one only, dominant allele for the individual to have the dominant phenotype. So one uppercase P is sufficient to be fully purple. And the converse of that is that if there's complete dominance, then the only way to have the recessive trait or recessive phenotype is to be homozygous recessive. It's the only way to avoid having one or more dominant alleles, right? Is to have both of your alleles be recessive. So that's what's going on here. Because of dominance, they're all purple because they're all heterozygous individuals, and since it's complete dominance, they're just as purple as one that's upper P. Is all that clear? Okay, now these are diploids of the next generation, the F1s. He then took F1 and crossed it with another F1 hundreds of times. But they're all F1s, so they all have the same genotype. Okay, they're all uppercase P, lowercase P. So when we abbreviate that cross, we could do it just with the genotypes. Upper, lower P, X for the cross, upper, lower P. That describes F1 crossed with another F1. Well, back in the P generation, remember, it didn't matter which of the alleles was chosen by meiosis because they were true breeding or homozygous. Now, for the F1 crossed with F1, it does matter which allele you choose randomly. Right? In other words, a heterozygous individual, unlike a true breeder, can produce two different gametes with respect to the characteristic. This parent can produce a purple egg or a white egg. This parent can produce a purple sperm or a white sperm, depending on which P is randomly chosen.
So that's a 50-50?
Yes, they're equal chances. It's like a coin flip. And therefore, when you get a gamete from this together with a gamete from this, there's going to be more than one possibility, unlike for the P generation. And we can represent or exhaustively list every possible combination of gametes in this thing that's shown on the bottom here, which is called a Punnett square. Punnett was an English biologist. The Punnett square is really just a shorthand device, but it represents a real biological process. What is the real biological process that's being represented?
Different outcomes it can have.
What did you say?
I was just thinking sexual reproduction.
Well, that is too general. That includes a lot of different things, including production of gametes. That's part of sexual reproduction. What specific part of sexual reproduction is represented by the Punnett square? What process? The defining process of sexual reproduction. What actually defines it as sex?
Fertilization.
That's what a Punnett square represents. Fertilization involving two specific parents. And so think back to what fertilization is. What's the definition?
The union.
Right. The union or the fusion of what? Well, they're usually called sperm and egg, but not always. Fertilization, though, generally speaking, is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce what? One unicellular zygote. So two cells fuse into one cell that now carries DNA from both, chromosomes from both gametes. Well, for any two given parents, a Punnett square simply shows in boxes the possibilities, but this one has four boxes. Not all Punnett squares are the same size, as we'll see, but this one has four boxes. What real things are represented by each box? Well, the genotypes correspond to them, but what does each genotype correspond to? No? I mean, traits are involved here, yes. But what is the product of fertilization? Yes, that's what each box in a Punnett square represents. A possible zygote that these two parents can produce with respect to the one characteristic that you care about. Of course, as we already said, there's almost an infinite number of possible zygotes when you consider all traits, all characteristics. But when you restrict your attention to just one characteristic, these two particular parents can each produce two kinds of gametes, and therefore getting one of the two eggs together with one of the two sperm results in four possible zygote types. Now, this does not say that these two parents are going to have four offspring. They could have one offspring or 4 million offspring, whatever. However many they have, though, each individual zygote is going to be one of these four possibilities when all you care about is flower color. Each one is going to have one of these four genotypes. But really, notice that there's three genotypes. Right? There's upper P when you get these two gametes together, upper-lower P, upper-lower P another way, and then lower-lower P. Because of complete dominance, though, all you need is one upper P to be fully purple, right? So what this Punnett square tells you is however many offspring are produced by these two parents, you would expect 3/4 of them to have purple flowers and 1/4 of them to have white flowers. In other words, in the F2 generation, if you go through all the steps, the F2 generation should have a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, 3 dominants to 1 recessive. And that's exactly what Mendel found in all of 7 of his experiments, because he did it hundreds of times, so he got good numbers. Now, because of complete dominance, notice that there's two different ways to become purple. You can be homozygous dominant, which this one is. There's only one way to produce that. You have to get this egg and this sperm together. But a heterozygous individual is fully purple as well because of complete dominance, and there's two ways that can happen. You can get your purple from your mother, or you can get your purple from your father. The other one's white. So half of the overall offspring will be heterozygous individuals. A quarter of them will be homozygous dominant, and a quarter of them will be homozygous recessive. So there's 3 genotypes, but 2 phenotypes. And you can see that in slide 7, which gives you 2 ratios. On the left side, as we just talked about, there is a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, because there's only 2 phenotypes, either purple or white. But since there's 2 ways to be purple, 2 different genotypes, that means there's 3 overall genotypes, and the genotypic ratio in the F2 is 1-to-2-to-1. Now, those numbers are not particular to flower color. Any characteristic that behaves in a Mendelian fashion will have these same ratios in the F2 generation. That's if you're talking about a Mendelian characteristic or a Mendelian gene. Okay, obviously named after Mendel. So what we're studying here is Mendelian genetics. For things to operate this way, in other words, for these particular ratios to emerge in the F2, there have to be two requirements met for it to be Mendelian. One is that there have to be exactly two alleles for the gene in being studied. Correspondingly, another way of saying it, in other words, there have to be exactly two traits for the one characteristic that you're paying attention to. And there are here, right? There's no other colors possible. The other requirement for Mendelian genetics is that one of those two alleles has to be completely dominant over the other. Or, rephrased, one of those two traits has to be completely dominant over the other. Which it is here. Yeah.
So what about in sex cells? Or not sex cells, sorry. What about in...
sex chromosomes?
Yes.
Well, that is going to be an exception to Mendelian genetics. And the second half of this overall slideshow is devoted to various ways that you have exceptions to Mendelian genetics, which collectively are called non-Mendelian genetics. So that's one example of that. And so we'll talk a little bit about that once we get to those slides. But right now we're still in Mendelian genetics. Just keep in mind that for it to behave in a Mendelian fashion, and for you to get the famous 3-to-1 ratio or other ratios that we're about to talk about, you have to have both of those requirements met. Exactly two alleles for the characteristic under study, and one completely dominates over the other. Okay, now, slide 8 is not the same cross, even though we're still looking at flower color here, as an example, in pea plants. This is a different kind of cross. This is a test cross. It's one version of a test cross. Keep in mind the definitions of phenotype and genotype as I go on here for a couple minutes. If you have pea plants, flower color is your characteristic that you're concerned with, you can simply look at a recessive individual, a white-flowered individual, in other words, and, well, of course, you know the phenotype just by looking at it because it's a visible phenotype, right? White flowers is visible. So obviously you know the phenotype just by observing the individual. But also that's enough to know the genotype as well. Because there's only one way that you can become white-flowered. Since it's the recessive trait in a Mendelian characteristic, that means the only way that's possible genotypically is to be homozygous recessive. So without looking at the DNA of that individual, you know that it's lowercase p, right? But if you look at a purple flowered or dominant individual, all you know is the phenotype. And that's because there are two separate ways, two genotypes, that can get you that dominant trait. You don't know, in other words, whether it is homozygous dominant or heterozygous, if it's dominant. And knowing its genotype can be useful in a lot of cases. For instance, if you're breeding them, you might want to have true breeding individuals so that there's no possibility of producing recessive offspring. Or for any other reason, it's useful knowledge to know what the actual genotype is. And you can't tell that by direct observation of the phenotype in a dominant individual. But you can figure it out using a test cross like this. In this kind of test cross, the reason the cross is conducted is to ascertain the genotype of a dominant phenotype individual. Okay, so you know the phenotype going into it. You want to pin it down as to whether that individual is homozygous dominant or heterozygous. You do that by using Punnett square predictions. Each Punnett square is a prediction, really, right? Each Punnett square is a prediction of the ratios of genotypes and therefore phenotypes. So there's two Punnett squares shown here. Since we don't know the genotype of the individual purple flower, that's the one that we're trying to figure out. That's the reason we're doing the test cross. So we know it's either upper P or upper lower P. But each of those two possibilities is part of its own Punnett square. The cross that's done here, the test cross, is to take that dominant individual with unknown genotype and cross it with a individual of recessive phenotype, the white-flowered individual. All right, well, if this purple one is indeed homozygous, upper P, then you would have this Punnett square. And notice that the prediction is that white should be impossible in the offspring. 100% of the offspring should be purple. On the other hand, if it's uppercase, lowercase P, if this purple one is heterozygous, then this is the Punnett square, and you should see half of the offspring be purple and half be white. Those are just predictions. Then you can actually go ahead and do the cross and look at the real offspring. Well, if you get even one white offspring, this is refuted, right? You know it's this. On the other hand, if you get all purple, it really depends on how many you make. Right? If it just has one offspring and it's purple, that does not prove that it's this one. But if you have hundreds and there's no white, pretty good bet it's this one's the true one. Anyway, that's what a test cross is all about. And that takes us to 9. Now, this is another cross, but this is not a monohybrid cross. This is a dihybrid cross. So what's the difference compared to a monohybrid cross?
Two different characteristics.
Right. Two characteristics are simultaneously being considered. It does not at all say that the characteristics are related to each other. It just means that you're choosing to study two characteristics at the same time and ignoring all other characteristics. And the hybrid part still means the same thing. The parents differ in their traits, but now they differ in their traits for each of two different characteristics. What are the characteristics here?
Shape and color.
Of what? What are these things? They're peas.
Okay.
Yeah, so the peas themselves are the seeds, right? So seed color is one characteristic. Seed texture is another characteristic. Everything else we ignore, but we pay attention to those two characteristics. And this is a Mendelian cross. So what does that tell you?
There's two alleles, one completely dominant.
Right. So for color, for seed color, there's only two possible colors, green and yellow. And one of them is completely dominant over the other. happens to be that yellow is dominant over green. At the same time, though, we're paying attention to seed texture, which there's only two possibilities for. It can be either round or smooth or wrinkled. Now look at the genotypes of the parents. Each genotype contains four symbols, right? But it's a sequence of pairs of symbols. There's two Y's and there's two R's. So make sense of that in your mind, that what you're really talking about is the fact that there are two different letters, a Y and an R involved, means that you're tracking two different characteristics, right? There's the Y gene and the R gene. Or it's probably better to call the Y gene the color gene and the R gene the texture gene. But there's two Y's in the overall genotype because this is a diploid parent, right? So upper Y, upper R is one parent. Lower Y, lower R is the other parent. We use Y's here because yellow is dominant over green. So uppercase Y's are the actual yellow versions of the alleles. Lowercase Y's are the green versions. We use R here for round, which corresponds to smooth, the same thing as smooth. That's dominant over wrinkled, which is lowercase r. And so in this particular dihybrid cross, each parent is doubly homozygous, doubly true breeding, right? One of the parents is doubly homozygous dominant, meaning that one parent is homozygous dominant with respect to color, it's yellow, and homozygous dominant with respect to texture, it's round. The other is doubly homozygous recessive. It's homozygous recessive with respect to color, it's green, and it's homozygous recessive with respect to texture because it's wrinkled. Does that all make sense with respect to what the genotypes are? Well, the fact that you're paying attention to two different characteristics simultaneously doesn't change anything about what's happening biologically. And so the same thing has to be true for this cross to go through, meaning that before that happens, the parents have to make gametes via meiosis. But what it means in this case, since you care about both color and texture, is that meiosis is going to randomly choose one Y and one R from each parent to produce the gametes. Well, these are true breeders. So once again, with respect to color and texture, this parent can make only one kind of gamete. Uppercase Y, uppercase R. Doesn't matter which Y you choose or which R you choose, they're both uppercase. And this one can produce only lowercase Y, lowercase R gametes. Therefore, regardless of which gametes are produced by these two parents, when you get them together to produce the F1 offspring, every one of those offspring is going to have the same genotype with respect to these two characteristics. Upper, lower Y, upper, lower R. In other words, every one of the F1s is going to be doubly heterozygous. And because both of these characteristics are Mendelian, that means the dominance is complete. So a double heterozygous individual is going to be doubly dominant with respect to phenotype. It's going to be dominant for color and for texture. In other words, every one of the F1s is going to be both round and yellow, as pictured. So nothing has changed here. You're just simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics. Okay, now, once again, we can produce an F2. But here's where this gets a little different from other slides. Because we have two Punnett squares shown here. And that's because we're testing two different hypotheses. the hypothesis of dependent assortment and the hypothesis of independent assortment. Only one of those is true. But each of them, if you assume it's true, leads to its own set of predictions, and therefore to its own Punnett square, which is the set of predictions. All right? So think back about what assortment just by itself means. What does that mean? What specifically does assortment refer to? Well, in everyday language, yes, but I'm talking about in genetics. First of all, what process is assortment part of? Yeah, I was going for meiosis, but yes, specifically in meiosis, it's metaphase. Now, what does assortment actually refer to, though?
How individual tetrad lines up.
Exactly right. A tetrad can line up either of two ways. Remember that we were using red and blue in the cartoons. A tetrad can line up red up and blue down, or blue up and red down. So two possibilities per tetrad. Well, dependent assortment, if it were true, means that they all line up with red in the same direction and blue in the same direction. Meaning that either they all line up red up and blue down, or they all line up blue up and red down. Because they all depend on each other. In other words, in dependent assortment, just one coin would be flipped for the entire cell. How many tetrads are there, by the way? In a cell in meiosis. How many overall tetrads? Well, what is a tetrad? Yes, and specifically a homologous pair that has synapsed. So they're not really a tetrad, even though they're homologous to begin with, they're not a tetrad until those homologs come together. So how many of those are there in a cell that's undergoing meiosis? How many tetrads? What's the general answer?
N.
Yes, there are N tetrads, right? The haploid number tells you how many kinds of chromosomes there are. Each tetrad is different because it's a different type of chromosome. But there's two of them in one tetrad. Okay, so there's N of those things lining up. Well, if it's independent assortment, each individual tetrad flips its own coin. And so you have some that are red up and blue down, some that are blue up and red down. That's the fundamental difference between these two competing hypotheses. One of them has to be true. There's no other mathematical possibility, right? So one of these hypotheses has to be true. If you assume that it's dependent, then that would lead to this Punnett square. And the dominant versions that are coming from one parent would go together for both color and texture. And recessives from the other parent would have to go together either as... what I'm getting at is that if you have dependent assortment, you should be able to produce only from these two parents zygotes that are of parental type. In genetics, we use the phrase parental type to indicate any individual that is like one parent or the other, fully, phenotypically. So notice that these three are just like the left parent, and this one is just like the right parent. So there are only parental types that are produced. The other types that can be produced are called recombinant types, and they aren't like either parent entirely. They include a combination of traits from both parents. That's exactly right. An independent assortment, notice it features a bigger Punnett square because all possible combinations of alleles can be produced for each parent. They can produce four different kinds of sperm and four different kinds of eggs. You know, this is for the F2, right? You have two parents, both of which are upper Y, lower Y, upper R, lower R. When meiosis randomly chooses, it chooses a Y and an R. The four possibilities are upper Y, upper R, upper Y, lower R, lower Y, upper R, lower Y, lower R. And similarly for the other parent, just making the opposite kind of gametes. That's why you have four eggs and four sperm and therefore 16 boxes, 16 different zygote types possible, predicted under the assumption of an independent assortment. Well, I've already told you in the previous lecture that independent assortment is what really happens. So this is the one that comes true. And this leads to another famous Mendelian ratio. This is a dihybrid cross. So instead of having the 3-to-1 F2 ratio, which you have for a monohybrid cross, you have one that involves four numbers because there's four combinations of traits here. You can be phenotypically, any individual produced in the F2 can be either doubly dominant, meaning yellow and round, dominant recessive, meaning yellow and wrinkled, recessive dominant, which would be green and round, or doubly recessive, green and wrinkled. All four of them are possible here. And therefore, the phenotypic ratio involves four numbers, but it's 9-to-3 to 3-to-1. Because of yellow's dominance over green, there's 9 ways that you can be yellow and round. There's only one way that you can be green and wrinkled, because you have to use this particular egg and this particular sperm to be lower, lower Y, lower, lower R. But if it's two Mendelian characteristics that you're talking about and you undergo the whole thing, doesn't matter what those characteristics are, you're still going to get a 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 ratio in the F2 because of that Mendelian, the way Mendelian genetics works.
As far as we know, the only time they get that one type is just random by chance?
Yes, it's entirely random. And as a matter of fact, I think the very next slide uses coins to indicate that. Yeah, slide 10. This is in a simpler one for the flower color one. But if you have, notice it's upper lower R crossed with upper lower R. So heterozygous crossed with heterozygous. Each, therefore, being heterozygous is able to make two different gametes, two eggs, two sperm. And they're equally likely. That's what random fertilization is. Remember that third part of the third way that sex increases genetic variation is with random fertilization. That means you randomly choose an egg, you randomly choose a sperm. Well, since we're restricting our attention to just this one characteristic, whatever R represents, that means you're flipping a coin because there's two eggs possible, two sperm possible. And to make a particular zygote, you have to pick this egg and this sperm, so the overall probability of that is the product of the individual probabilities of the gametes. So 1/2 times 1/2, which is 1/4. And similarly for all the other three possible zygotes, and notice that all of those 1/4 add up to 1, which is 100%, all of the possibilities. Yeah, there's nothing favoring one gene, one gamete over another. They're totally randomly chosen. All right. That is Mendelian genetics, or the basics of Mendelian genetics. And so for all of what we've been talking about, those two requirements were met, meaning that for each characteristic, there is exactly two possible traits, or for each gene, there's exactly two possible alleles, and one of those two traits is totally dominant over the other. That's been true up to now. When those conditions, or at least one of those conditions, isn't met, then you have exceptions to Mendelian genetics, which collectively are called non-Mendelian genetics, and that's what the rest of the chapter is about. The first example in slide 11 is called incomplete dominance. And you should know just from the name of it that it's an exception to Mendelian genetics, right? Because one of the requirements of Mendelian genetics is complete dominance. Well, this is incomplete dominance. How many characteristics are we looking at here? One, what is it? Flower color. And how many traits? Three. So that also tells you it's an exception, right? You have one characteristic with three traits, that's not Mendelian. The reason this is called incomplete dominance is that there is dominance still, that's why dominance is in the name, but it's no longer the case that having just one dominant allele is enough to give you the fully dominant trait. In incomplete dominance, it takes two dominant alleles for you to fully have the dominant trait. In other words, you have to be homozygous dominant, in this case, to be fully red-flowered. Just like before, the only way to become recessive is to be homozygous recessive. That's the white-flowered individual. But the only other possible genotype, of course, is heterozygous, right? And in this case, which just depends on the gene and the organism, in this case, one dominant allele isn't enough to fully make you red. Which you should think about in terms of what genes actually do, right? What genes are coding indirectly for proteins. So if you have a homozygous dominant individual, and by the way, notice we use a different standard here with the genotypes when it's not a Mendelian case. The C here stands for color, the flower color gene, and then as a superscript you use either R or W to indicate red or white. But if you are a homozygous dominant individual, CR, that means you have, compared to a heterozygous individual, twice as many alleles corresponding to red proteins. And what does that DNA do? It gets transcribed, right, into mRNA. Well, there's a red version of mRNA that a red gene, a red allele, will produce in transcription. If you have twice as many of those mRNAs that you can make in a given amount of time, then when they get translated into the protein that actually gives you the redness, you can make twice as much of that protein in a given amount of time if you're homozygous dominant, compared to a heterozygous individual. And sometimes that matters, like it does here. For the purple flowered pea plants, it just didn't matter in that case. Half of the amount is still enough to make it indistinguishably purple. Fully purple. All right? But if you're not making any of the red protein, you're going to be white. And that's going to happen if you don't have any red alleles, if you're homozygous recessive. All right, so that is one possible exception to Mendelian genetics called incomplete dominance. The slide 12 is actually two examples in one. And I could probably get through this, but this is where I stopped for my other section. So I'm just going to stop here, keep them even.